When she saw the blood, she moved toward it, carrying her phone with her as she ran out the kitchen door. She prided herself on being someone who moved toward things, even if they were frightening or gory or just plain uncomfortable. She didn't shrink back like some people. She wanted to be of help, to be that person about whom people later remarked, "I just don't know what I would have done if you hadn't been there." She ran to Deborah's side and knelt there with her, beside the older child, Lila. "What can I do?" She tried to gauge just where the blood was coming from and whether Lila was critically injured. It was an accident that started it all, and an accident that ended it. The little girl's shoelace had tangled in the bicycle chain, and she'd toppled over, her sneakers still affixed to the bicycle in such a way that every time they moved her, the bicycle grated along the concrete, making a horrible scraping noise. She looked at Deborah's panicked face, the way the blood was informing her reaction, and rested a hand on her shoulder. "I think maybe we should take her to the hospital," she said, willing her voice to sound calm and relaxed. She was almost certain the little girl had broken something, and the cut on her leg that was the source of all the blood was of concern as well. It was deep and jagged, lying open like a yawning mouth. Zell tried to brush some of the dirt from it, but Lila went crazy trying to get away from her touch. Zell extracted the shoelaces from the chain and scooped up Lila, carrying her as she ordered the uncertain Deborah to grab Alec and follow her to her car. They settled Deborah and Lila in the back seat, with Alec tucked in, too, and set off. Zell sat in the waiting room and entertained Alec while they waited for Lila to be stitched up. Lance showed up and offered to take care of him, but Zell sent him into the exam room to be with his wife and child, magnanimously staying put, her arm around Alec. "You go," she'd said and waved him away. "Lila will want to see you." Lance had looked skeptical, glancing at Alec, who was intent on finishing a drawing Zell had started out of desperation. She'd meant it to be a dog, but he'd turned it into a cat, his lips pursed in concentration as he applied the whiskers to the face. "He's fine," she said, her voice assuring. She waited for him to say that she was a lifesaver, but he didn't. Instead, he ruffled his son's hair and trotted off down the hall. He disappeared into the room they'd had Lila and Deborah in for hours. Lila had to have stitches in her leg, and she had a broken collarbone which required a sling. Eventually, Lance took Alec home, and Zell, uncertain what to do without the child to mind, decided to go home too. She knocked tentatively at the door she'd seen Lance disappear into and heard a weak, "Come in response. She poked her head inside the room to see Lila asleep, her arm bound to her side, her leg resting atop a pillow. Deborah was slouched in a chair beside her bed, staring vacantly at a TV with the sound turned off. "I was just going to go home. Unless there's anything else I can do?" she said. Deborah shook her head. "They're about to release us." Deborah covered her eyes with her hands, like Ty used to do when he was very small and thought that if he couldn't see her, she couldn't see him. She heard small sobbing sounds and waited politely for Deborah to collect herself, wondering if she should just back out of the room or wait to be dismissed. She moved inside the room and let the door swing shut behind her. Finally, Deborah spoke. "I'm sorry for crying." She swiped at her eyes, embarrassed. "It's okay. You've been through a lot." "You know what I was thinking just before this happened?" Deborah asked, picking at a cuticle instead of looking at Zell. She went on with her story before Zell could admit that she had no idea what the younger woman was thinking moments before her daughter had a bike accident. Before Zell had heard the screaming, she hadn't thought of Deborah at all. Deborah answered her own question, her answer coming out in a rush of words. "I was thinking that this isn't so bad. The kids are starting to get older, and Alec will go to kindergarten in the fall, and I won't be so tied down. They can play outside without me helping them or watching their every move, and maybe, just maybe, I might end up like the others." She finished speaking, lifted her finger to her mouth, and began to chew at a piece of stray skin on her cuticle. Zell's daughter had a nasty habit of doing the same thing, Her fingers were a mess. She thought about lecturing Deborah the same way she lectured Melanie, but decided against it. She was not this girl's mother. "The others?" she asked gently. Deborah still didn't meet her gaze. She continued to nibble at the skin on her cuticle for a moment, then spat out the piece of skin she'd been trying to chew away. "The other mothers. The ones who seem to actually enjoy this gig." Her finger began to bleed, and she put it back in her mouth, sucking the blood away. Zell was repulsed, but tried not to show it. She spoke quietly, cautiously, the way one might speak to a child. "I'm not sure any one of us is enjoying all of it fully, not the way you might think." Deborah's laugh was a scoff. "That's easy for you to say." Finally, she raised her eyes. "You're already past the worst part. You're home free." She gestured to Zell. "And look at you. You're wearing a white shirt, and there isn't a speck of ketchup or grease or a child's lip print or dirt on it. And I bet you're what, a size 4? Zell had almost corrected her. She was a size 2 then, but decided it was better to keep that detail to herself. Deborah gestured at her own stomach, pooching onto her lap. "I've been trying to get the baby weight off since Alec was born." When her voice raised at the end, Lila started to stir. She blanched and went back to speaking in an emphatic whisper. "You might be just trying to survive." She held her hands up to make air quotes. "But your survival and mine are light years apart." Her voice got softer, and her eyes flickered away again, this time toward the window. "I watch you go running every day, and I think, I wish I could do that, just run away like that. The difference is, I'm not sure I'd come back like you do." She glanced back over toward Zell, her expression caught somewhere between shame and surrender. She shrugged her shoulders as if it were nothing and straightened her back. "Thanks for helping out today. I don't know what I would have done without you there, and I'm sorry for falling apart in front of you." "You've been through a traumatic experience," Zell said. "You're entitled to fall apart." A little burst of laughter escaped Deborah's lips. "Tell that to my family," she said. Zell was about to speak again, to say something, anything to put Deborah's mind at ease. She wanted to tell her that she knew exactly how she felt and that it would get better. The kids would stop needing her quite the way they needed her now. The intensity would ebb, at least. She wanted to tell her that there would come a day when she could go for a run uninhibited, when she could run away, as she put it. She wanted to tell her that this reality wasn't the only one there was, forever, that nothing stayed the same. But just as she opened her mouth to speak, the nurse bustled in with the discharge papers, speaking loudly enough to rouse Lila and giving Zell a pointed look that told her it was time to vacate the premises. She mumbled something about getting out of their way, but no one heard her. She slipped out, feeling vaguely guilty, as though she'd done something wrong, seen something she shouldn't have. She stopped and picked up Chinese takeout for dinner, then at the last minute went ahead and picked up some entrees for Deborah's family, too. It wasn't a homemade meal, she'd see to that tomorrow, but it was food, and it was, after all, dinner time. She sent John next door with the neighbor's food, put some out for her own hungry brood, then made it to book club, and kept up with the discussion, even though she never did finish the book. She sipped wine and made small talk with the other women, all the while thinking about what Deborah had said, and wondering just what she could do about it. Should she invite her to book club? Offer to keep the kids for her? It wasn't until she was doing her stretches before bed that she hit upon an idea. Years later, she could still feel the little zing of inspiration that traveled up her spine at the moment she thought of it. She pictured Deborah gesturing to her stomach, pointing at Zell's smaller body. Everything that happened after came from that one idea, which came from that strange encounter in the hospital room when a woman she barely knew bared her soul, admitting something Zell felt quite sure Deborah had admitted aloud to no one else. Her confession left Zell feeling responsible. She had never been able to turn away from another person's pain. Kaylee. I asked Zell what hurt, and she said, "Everything." I tried to help out, bringing her aspirin and fixing her a Coke in the same blue cup she'd given me that first day. I even remembered a coaster. When Zell got sick, I knew that my days were numbered, and I better do everything I had in mind to do right quick. I'd already been on borrowed time ever since Cutter woke up. Mama agreeing to let me stay with Zell those extra days had been nothing short of a miracle, and I wasn't one to ignore miracles. Zell called those extra days bonus time. I didn't say so, but I liked it that she felt that way. My eyes got all watery when I thought of having to say goodbye, but neither one of us wanted to talk about that yet. We worked hard to get the yard ready to be approved as a wildlife habitat, finishing up the last items on the punch list, as Zell called it. Truth is, I was sure it was all that working outside in the heat that made Zell sick. I felt bad about it, even though she told me not to give it a minute's thought. She took the aspirin and drank a little bit of the Coke. Then she fell sound asleep, which was my chance. I'd been meaning to get back over to Mr. Doyle's house ever since he'd given me that popsicle, but I swear it wasn't to see him. I wanted to visit his mama, because he told me she'd been feeling bad. He said that she was getting weaker and weaker, and he thought she might die. I drew her a picture I thought might make her happy, and I intended to take it over to her before I left. When Zell asked me about it, I told her it was for Cutter, which she said was really sweet. It was just a little lie. I opened the door really quietly, but it still made a click when I shut it, so I stood there on the stoop for a few minutes to see if it woke Zell up. I watched her, but she didn't move. I hoped she felt better when she got up. One good thing was that she didn't have to cook dinner for me that night, as Mama and the ambulance guy were taking me out. Just me. The thought of their four eyes staring at me while I ate made my stomach feel quivery, so I tried not to think about it. I didn't see how I was going to get a bite of food down. I looked down at the picture in my hands as I walked. I'd drawn a rainbow and a sun and some birds. I didn't think about it till I was already across the street, but the picture was all things in the sky, which I guessed was where Mr. Doyle's mama was headed soon. Up to the sky, with God. I didn't know if that was the right or wrong thing to draw. Does a person who's getting ready to go up to heaven want to think about it? Maybe she didn't. I had just about convinced myself to go back to Zell's and draw another picture entirely when Mr. Doyle came out on his front porch and called my name. He yelled it kind of loud, and I was worried somehow Zell would hear and come running outside to shoo me back into her house and get that worried look she got whenever Mr. Doyle's name came up. Then I remembered how still she was on her couch, her chest rising and falling in a slow rhythm. I looked back at her house, saw no sign of her, turned back and waved hello. He said, "Well, Kaylee, tell me what brings you this way." He had a funny smile on his face, like he knew the answer to a riddle I didn't know. I held up the picture. "I drew it," I said, "for your mama." He peered at the picture, his glasses sliding down slightly when he did. His mouth was open, and I could smell the coffee he'd been drinking. I had to work hard to keep from wrinkling my nose from the smell. He looked from the picture to me and back again. "You're a very good artist, Kaylee. I think my mother is going to be very pleased to receive this." He started to reach for it, but I pulled it away. I wanted to give it to her myself. I looked at his face to see if he was mad. I'd never been inside his house before. I didn't think anyone had in years, except Mr. Doyle, his mother, and Jesse. When I'd eaten the popsicle, he'd seemed to want to stay outside. He got that look on his face again, that answer to the riddle look, and gave me a little smile. He reached out and ruffled my hair. "Well, sure, Kaylee," he said. "You can come in and give my mother your picture." He kept his hand on my head, and it felt heavy and warm. He didn't seem to mind that my head was all sweaty. "You're a thoughtful girl," he said. "You don't see that too much in this world." He beckoned me into the house, and I followed him in through the front door, which led into a front room that had a couple of couches and a big TV turned on loud to cartoons, though no one was watching it. I assumed Jesse, who was kind of like an overgrown boy, had been watching it but lost interest. Cutter did that sometimes, and he never remembered to turn it off. I had to do that, or else my mother lectured us about the cost of electricity and threatened to put the TV in the closet. She'd done it once before, so we knew she was serious. I followed Mr. Doyle back toward the kitchen, still holding my picture. We passed a door that was padlocked. I looked at the lock, then back at him. There must have been a funny look on my face, because he rushed to explain. "There's stairs leading down to the basement on the other side of that door. My mother fell down them, so I had to lock it up. I can't always be here, you know." He waved me on toward the kitchen, and I moved with him, away from the locked door. I'd heard of childproofing, but not adult-proofing. I thought about saying that to him, but then wondered if he'd think it was funny. He might not. The smell from the kitchen hit my nose before we rounded the corner, a mixture of rotten food and burned coffee. I walked in and tried to keep the shocked expression from showing up on my face, but I don't think I did a very good job because he laughed. "Guess I need to hire a housekeeper, huh?" He gestured to the mess. "Like I said, I can't always be here." Dishes with food still stuck to them were piled in the sink and overflowed down the counters. A puddle of something was in the middle of the floor. Trash was spilling out of the trash can, and other full trash bags, loosely tied off, were lined up down the wall. Once I got inside the room, the smell burned my nose, and I had to breathe out of my mouth to keep from gagging. He pulled a chair out from the rickety table in the corner of the room, sidestepping the spill as he did so I could sit. He waved his hand over it like a waiter in a fancy restaurant and said, "Have a seat, madame," like he was trying to be French. I sat down and started to lay my picture on the table, but then thought better of it, fearing I'd lay it in some sticky patch and ruin it. "Let me just see if my mother's awake," he said, and left the room. I just sat there, waiting for my nose to adjust and hoping he didn't leave me long. I listened to his footsteps fade away and looked around the room at the mess. Part of me thought maybe I should get up and wash the dishes or do something to help. I thought of Zill's perfectly clean house across the street. You could practically eat off her floors. And in that moment, I wished I could teleport myself back there, back to the place I'd just slipped away from. I thought of Zill, obliviously sleeping away. What if she woke up and I was gone? Would she even guess where I was? My stomach clenched with guilt, and deeper, something else I couldn't name. I looked around for a clock so I could keep an eye on the time and not be gone too long. There was a clock on the wall, a round black and white one, the kind they had in every school I'd ever been to. But it had stopped, its hands frozen at 10 and 2. I looked at the microwave, but the readout said 34, like someone had been cooking something and stopped the process before the timer ran out. I got up and moved over to the microwave to clear the readout, so I could see the actual time. It was 2:22. If I hurried, I could get back before Zell woke, and she'd never know the difference. I spotted a small bag on top of the microwave with the letters CVS stamped in red on the outside. I could hear my mother's voice in my head telling me not to snoop, but I couldn't help being curious, and there was nothing else to do while I waited except look around. So I peeked inside. My eyes took a few seconds to register what I saw inside the bag. I looked at the items, trying to make the things I saw in the bag fit with where I was. Inside the bag was a small box of tampons, a bag of Sour Patch Kids candy, and purple nail polish. I tried to think which one of the three people who lived there would have use for those items. Maybe Jesse liked sour candy. But I doubted any of the three of them had use for tampons or purple nail polish. I knew that women don't get their periods anymore after they get old, and I would think that a dying old woman wasn't going to be painting her nails, and she wouldn't be painting them purple if she did. I heard a door close in the back of the house and the sound of feet walking back toward the kitchen. I hurried back to the table and sat down as if I'd never moved, my heart pounding like I'd just run a marathon. I was sitting there, holding my picture, trying not to look rattled, when he came back in. "I'm sorry," he said. "My mother's asleep." He held his hand out. "But I'll take that pretty picture of yours and give it to her just as soon as she wakes up. How's that?" I nodded, suddenly mute and wishing I'd never gone into Mr. Doyle's house. The air seemed to have changed, as if it were polluted by the dirty kitchen, or something else. I didn't dare let my eyes stray to that little bag on top of the microwave, lest I give myself away. I handed over the picture, and he stared down at it for a few seconds before putting it under a magnet on the gold refrigerator. Satisfied with where he placed it, he turned back. "Would you like a popsicle?" His eyes looked eager as he spoke, and I knew saying no would disappoint him, but I couldn't stop thinking about the bag on the microwave and how strange I felt there all of a sudden. I thought about how upset Zell had been the last time I'd gone over, the look she had in her eyes when she warned me about Mr. Doyle. I probably should have listened to her. I stood up. I should get back. Zell was asleep when I left, and I don't want her to worry. Mr. Doyle nodded, his lips pursed as he looked at me. Then he smiled and put his arm around me. I could smell the sweat under his arms, the oil from his pores, the coffee on his breath. "Let me walk you out," he said. We stopped in the doorway. "I don't suppose you'd like to help me build one of those ponds like you and Zell built. I was thinking I'd do that for my mother. Then maybe she could sit outside by it in the fall when the weather gets cooler." I thought about how his mother would like that, and how probably Zell was wrong about him. "I'd pay you something for your trouble," he added. I couldn't deny that I could use the money. That was one thing I'd never turned down. I figured Zell wouldn't say no if I was doing a job and actually getting paid real money for it. "I'll ask Zell," I said. He gave me that smile again, the one that said he knew something I didn't, and whatever it was amused him greatly. "You do that," he said. I took a step back, away from him and toward Zell's house. I thought he'd let go of me then, but he didn't. Instead, his grip tightened and he pulled me toward him. "Well, give me a hug goodbye," he said. His voice was disappointed, as if I was being ridiculous for even trying to leave without hugging him. I let him hug me, my arms limp at my sides. He stopped hugging me and looked into my eyes. His were brown and green, both, which is the color they call hazel. "You have to hug me back or it doesn't count," he said. Instead of resisting like I wanted to, I put my arms around him. I told myself I was doing the right thing, that I was just hugging a lonely man who didn't have anyone normal in his life to love him back. I gave him a little hug, like I used to give Joe when my mom made me. Then I pulled away quickly. "I'll let you know when I'm going to work on the pond. Gotta get some river rocks to put around it first. Don't you think that'd be pretty?" he asked. I nodded. "Sure," I said, even though I didn't have the faintest notion of what river rocks were. But I went along with it, because sometimes that was the easiest thing to do. Right. The conversation lasted less than 5 minutes. She knew because she looked at the timer after she pressed end. 4 minutes, 47 seconds. They'd spent little time catching up on their current lives, no time rehashing the past, which was just fine with her, and most of the time deciding when and where to meet.
"As luck would have it," he said, "I'm going to be near you for a meeting in a few days. Does that work for you?"
This had very little to do with luck. Or did it? "Yes," she said, "I can do that." She didn't need to check her calendar to know there was nothing on it, save another trip to the pool, another spin around the block with Christopher in the stroller, and a dog cinched to her side.
"So you could do Thursday, August 2nd, say 5:30? I should have my meetings wrapped up by then."
She would ask her mom to watch Christopher. Everett could pick him up from her house after work.
"Sure," she breathed. "Where?"
"I guess we could meet for a drink somewhere. A restaurant, maybe? Or we could just meet up in the lobby of the Marriott. That's where I'm staying."
She tried not to think about meeting him at a hotel, about his room upstairs that they could just walk right up to. That was the past. Things were different now. She was asking him to help her get back into the career she'd left behind. That was all. She exhaled.
"The hotel lobby is fine."
"Okay, doll," he said, and she could hear him smile through the phone.
She remembered that smile all too well. She cringed, remembering how he had called her that, how there was a time she'd found it charming.
"Okay, well, see you then."
She tried to keep her voice light, happy.
"And bright?" he asked, just before she could end the call. I'm glad you called. It'll be good to see you again. We never really..."
"Yeah, me too,"
she said, not wanting him to finish whatever he was about to say. She blurted a goodbye before ending the call. She held the phone in her hand and blinked at the 4:47 display, thinking about how surprisingly easy it was to decide to change your life forever, and how surprisingly easy it was to keep that decision from the one you loved the most. Jency. After that first night, their relationship unfolded with surprising ease. The days bled together in a summer haze. She felt as if she were living in one of those montages from a romantic movie. Here's the happy couple under the covers in bed, whispering and giggling and hiding from their kids. Here's the dad sneaking back into his own bed as the first light of dawn streaks the sky. Here are the two families eating burgers outside around the picnic table, the kids' mouths ringed with bright red ketchup. Here's him baiting her hook as they all fish at the neighborhood lake on the tacky metal pier, the setting sun painting the sky beyond them with wide brushstrokes of pink and orange and blue. It was weeks before she finally told him about Arch, her words coming out in a rush sometime in the wee hours of the morning. She rested her head on his chest and whispered the whole story, the flight to the college up north to escape her stalker's increasing menace, the whirlwind courtship, and building a life with this man she loved far from home, the criminal behavior she'd been oblivious to, the agents who looked remarkably like the men in black showing up, trampling all over her flowers and her life. She breathed the detail in one long exhale, and when she was finished, neither of them spoke, each thinking, she imagined, about how far afield their lives had gone. "Thanks," Lance finally spoke, "for telling me." He kissed the top of her head. "I'm sure that wasn't easy." She was getting used to his scent, his touch, his shape. She let herself lean into it, telling herself not to get too cozy as she did. Sometimes, after Lance snuck back to his own bed and she was left alone, she had stern talks with herself. This wasn't a permanent situation. It couldn't last between them. And yet, they behaved as if it could. The worst part was, they were dragging their children into it with them, the six of them forming this odd unit, complete with inside jokes and alliances that grew stronger with each passing summer day. Every day she told herself that soon they would talk about it, and every day it just didn't seem like a good time to bring up the future. Why put a damper on things? She would deal with it tomorrow,
or next week, or when he did. There was no need to mess with a good thing, because this was a good thing, and good things, she knew all too well, were rare and fleeting. She was just home from his house, arriving back at her parents' home late in the morning as usual, after they'd all had breakfast together. She'd made French toast, and her hair still smelled of bacon and syrup. She was thinking about a shower, about how long it would take him to get the work done that he needed to do, about what they'd do that evening, when she felt someone watching her. She looked over to find her mother standing on the back deck, looking in at her, a frown on her face. Jency felt her smile die on her own face. She swallowed, gave her mother a little wave. Instead of waving back, her mother beckoned to her, summoning her out to the deck. She nodded and walked toward her, thinking as she did just where the girls were, if they were in earshot of whatever her mother was about to say. Just to be safe, she closed the door behind her when she got out onto the deck. "Hey, Mom," she said, willing her voice to stay light and upbeat.
"Hi, Jency."
Her mother rarely referred to her by name, choosing a variety of other endearments instead. Honey, dear, sweetie. Lois Cabot's mouth was a straight line, and there were more wrinkles around it than Jency had ever noticed before. She wanted to reach over and smooth the wrinkles out, like she sometimes smoothed her daughter's clothes or hair. Instead, she clasped one hand inside the other, shifting her weight from one foot to the other. "What's up?" she asked.
"I take it this is going to be a habit?" Lois asked.
She almost played dumb and asked what her mother meant, but she was not a teenager anymore. "We were up late watching a movie, and I had a few glasses of wine, so I didn't want to drive. The kids fell asleep, and so I just slept in his guest room, Mom." She shrugged her shoulders for emphasis, as if she hadn't given her mother the exact same story multiple times in recent weeks.
"He's married, Jency."
Her mother using her name more than once in a conversation. This had to be some kind of record.
"It's nothing, Mom, I promise."
She held her hands up like the scales of justice. Lois continued,
"And you're in the midst of a very difficult time in your life."
She refrained from saying, "Thank you, Captain Obvious." Instead, she nodded, hoping to achieve a penitent, contemplative posture. "Our kids are friends. They enjoy spending time together. He's also been through something unexpected in his own life. We're good company for each other." The explanation sounded good in her own head. Reasonable.
"I know all about his wife leaving him."
Her mother raised an eyebrow.
"You forget how active the rumor mill is in this neighborhood."
She rolled her eyes.
"Oh, I remember. People are talking. They see your car there overnight. How much time the two of you are spending together." Lois said, "I just thought you'd want to know."
"People are always talking, Mom, in case you haven't noticed. It's whether you care what they're saying that matters." Her mother sniffed.
"If history is any indication, you'll move on, and we'll be left here to answer for you. So will he."
She knew this wasn't about Lance. It was about the past, about how her flight from this place had been a one-way ticket instead of a round trip. Her mother always thought she'd come back, had kept her old room intact as though she'd be back in a year instead of more than a decade. Though she'd never said it outright, Jency knew her mother had felt rejected when she'd decided to stay up north. But Jency didn't have it in her to argue about the past. She didn't have it in her to argue about the present, come to think of it. She wanted to hold on to the happiness she'd felt when she woke up, when she made breakfast, when they said they'd see each other later. She wanted to hold on to later. There was always something better just ahead. Isn't that what she'd spent her life believing? Isn't that what she'd fought hard to hold on to in recent months?
"I'm sorry, Mom," she said, again angling for a look of remorse underneath her mother's intense gaze.
I'll try to be less obvious.
She turned on her heel and stalked away, feeling every bit the teenager she'd once been, the old arguments rising up like ghosts. All that was missing was the slamming door. Kaylee.
When Zale got to feeling better, Ty came for dinner. He tried not to show he was mad when he found out I was using his old room, but when he thought I wasn't around, I heard him ask Zale, "Why didn't you put her in Melanie's room?" Zale said, "Shh." Then a few seconds later she added, "You don't live here anymore, so I'd say technically you don't have a room." I smiled to myself and waited a few minutes before I came back in the room so they wouldn't know I heard, though I suspected Ty wouldn't care if I did. He would really hate having me in his room if he knew I'd dug all through it, looking at his old stuff from when he was a kid. He'd probably want to help me pack and walk me out himself. But I was the one who'd been around all summer keeping his mother company, and it was the first I had seen of him. His brother and sister both lived out of town, so they had excuses not to come around, but he didn't. The whole time he was there, he watched me like I was going to make off with the family silver or some of Zell's jewelry. It wasn't hard for me to figure out he didn't like me very much. But to be honest, it seemed like he didn't like Zell or Mr. John very much either. He complained that Zell made chicken instead of steak, and pouted that she made roasted instead of mashed potatoes. I thought about the lame diary I'd found under his bed, covered in dust and forgotten. He'd kept a log of what he ate for dinner every night. Boring. I looked at his belly, hanging over his waistband. If you asked me, he was a little too concerned with food, and he didn't need potatoes at all. He needed one of those low-carb diets Zell was always talking about. Mr. John and him hardly spoke, and Zell just chattered about mindless stuff, the weather, our wildlife habitat, the new way she made the broccoli. "It's roasted instead of steamed," she said. "Isn't it so much better?" Ty just shrugged and kept shoveling food into his big open hole of a mouth. So I said I agreed it was much better roasted, which was a mistake, because then I had to listen to her explanation of how she made it, which went on way too long. Mr. John and Ty didn't seem to hear her at all. Ty didn't stay very long, though of course I wasn't sorry to see him go. Zell made me walk him out with her, and I did, but I lagged behind. I was happy to see that Lila, Alec, Pilar, and Zara were outside too, and waved at them as soon as I saw them. Pilar and Zara were over at Alec and Lila's all the time. I was a little jealous and wished my mom would date someone with kids my age, someone Cutter and I could hang out with all the time. I wondered if Ambulance Guy had kids. I doubted it. "Can I go over and say hi?" I asked. Zell said yes, and I started to run off, but then Zell hollered, "You forgot to tell Ty goodbye, Kaylee." I stopped and turned around, giving him my most sincere smile, which wasn't sincere at all. "Goodbye, Ty. It was nice to meet you," I said.
"You too,"
he said, but his voice told me he didn't mean it any more than I did. I skipped across the Brysons' yard toward the kids, who were swinging each other on the tire swing Mr. Lance had hung there a few weeks before. Pilar was pushing Alec, and Lila and Zara were doing Poof with the Attitude, a clapping game they did all the time. Mr. Lance and Miss Jensie were sitting on the picnic table, hardly paying attention to the kids. If they were, they would have told Pilar not to push Alec so high and Alec to hang on tighter. And they would have told Lila and Zara to find a new game to play, one that didn't get on all our last nerves because we'd hurt it so much.
"Hi, Kaylee,"
Miss Jensie called out as I walked by them, surprising me that they even saw me. She pointed out Ty's car, finally backing out of Zell's drive.
"Did you guys have company for dinner tonight?"
She was smiling. She was always smiling when she and Mr. Lance were together. She didn't smile much when I first met her, always wearing sunglasses and looking like she just came from a funeral. I stopped in front of the picnic table and eyed the graham crackers, Hershey's bars, and marshmallows stacked there. If I played my cards right, I might get a s'more. "Yes, ma'am," I said, using the same voice I used with Ty. It was the voice I used with most adults I didn't know all that well. I used it with Zell at first, but now I mostly forgot and just talked to her in my regular voice. Zell's son was here. Ty.
"Oh, Ty," Jensie said. "I knew Ty way back when."
Then I remembered. "Oh, yeah," I said. "You did know him." I raised my eyebrows and gave her a look. "You knew him pretty well." I looked over at Lance, who'd stopped holding Jensie's hand with me around, but they didn't fool me. "Don't get jealous, Mr. Lance," I said. "It was a long time ago." I froze, realizing what I'd done. In teasing them, I'd told on myself. But it was too late now. I could tell by the looks on their faces I was going to have to explain. I'd found a whole box of stuff in Ty's closet that had to do with Jensie. Little cut-out hearts with her name on them. Poems he'd written about her, which were so lame I laughed when I read them. And a lot of pictures of her, some with the heads of other people cut out in them. You could tell that, at least back then, she was the only girl for him. Which kind of didn't make any sense, because she seemed way too pretty for him. But who was I to know? Maybe back in high school he was a stud. He had the photo of her when she was homecoming queen, standing on a stage with a crown on her head, looking surprised and really, really happy. I started to walk over to the kids to see if I could get a turn on the tire swing when Jensie stopped me. "What was a long time ago, Kaylee?" she asked.
When you guys were boyfriend and girlfriend," I said, wishing I'd never said anything. I didn't want to stand there and discuss an adult's old boyfriend with her, especially when I'd just gotten away from his gross self. I waved my hand in the air like it didn't matter a hill of beans, as Zell would say, and started to walk away again. But Jensie stopped me again.
"Kaylee, we were never boyfriend and girlfriend. I barely knew him," she said. "Where would you get an idea like that?"
I looked at her, feeling a little sick inside for bringing it up. I didn't want to talk about it, whatever it was, anymore. But the way she was looking at me, I could tell I didn't have much choice.
I found a box of stuff in his, closet," I tried to explain. "I'm staying in his old bedroom," I added, as if that explained my snooping around in Ty's private stuff. The last thing I wanted was for her to tell Zell on me. I had no business rummaging through Ty's closet. I just got bored sometimes, and I was curious. I heard my mother's voice in my head. "I told you not to snoop in other people's things."
Jensie leaned forward, looking at me intently.
"What box of stuff?"
She looked as confused and sick as I felt. "There's an old shoebox in the back of his closet. I sort of opened it and looked through it one night when I couldn't sleep. And it has pictures of you and, poems he wrote about you and a lot of cut-out hearts with your name on them and stuff." I looked at Lance, who'd put his hand on her back and looked concerned. "I thought you'd know about it, like it was something he'd kept from when y'all went out. Like maybe he just couldn't bear to part with it or something." I looked down and drew a line in the grass with the toe of my tennis shoe, wishing I'd never walked over, wishing Zell had never made me come outside with her in the first place. Jensie hopped down from the picnic table.
"Can you show it to me?"
she asked, her voice sounding like it did when Pilar and Zara were bugging her at the pool, like she was working hard to keep from screaming. I shrugged.
"Sure," I said. I motioned for her to follow me and headed back to Zell's, thinking as we walked how in the world I was going to explain this one to her. Zell.
It didn't surprise Zell all that much, knowing the truth about Ty. She supposed in hindsight she'd known there was something off about him, especially in high school. He'd grown quieter and quieter, retreated more to his room. Zell worried about the usual things you saw on TV, drugs, drinking, depression. She'd wondered aloud to John about whether their middle child was having suicidal thoughts, or dealing with secret homosexuality, or involved with the wrong crowd. John told her to stop worrying so much, to leave the boy alone, that it would work out, and to quit inventing trouble where there wasn't any. But deep in her mother's heart, she knew something was wrong. And now, all these years later, as Jency Cabot sat in her kitchen table and pored over the disturbing contents of a long-hidden shoebox, she knew she should have listened to that nagging internal voice a little closer. Now she knew. It was her own son who'd driven Jency away all those years ago. Ty had been a threat, scaring that poor girl to death with his paper hearts left in the most disturbing places. Once, she'd heard through the neighborhood grapevine, a heart had been left on the bathroom counter when Jency emerged from the shower, the word love scrawled in steam on the mirror. Zell had known all about it, listening to Lois Cabot lament at the pool that last summer before they finally took Jency up north to an undisclosed college in an attempt to get her away from whoever it was. Lois wouldn't even tell the other mothers what school, saying it was just too dangerous. And it had gotten dangerous. One night when Jency had been meeting Everett, someone, her son, Zell knew now, had jumped poor Everett and beaten him up, leaving a heart on his unconscious body. Now Zell tried to think about that time in her mind, wondering if she'd seen marks on her son after the fight, if there'd been signs she'd ignored because, much as she would have said differently, she didn't really want to see. She thought of what had happened next door before Deborah left. She thought of her son, and it all made a sickening sort of sense. She had given birth to this child, she had raised him, and he had done something terrible. She saw with horrifying clarity her own influence in who he had become. "I'm sorry," Zell said over and over to Jency. "What can I do?" She wrung her hands and paced the kitchen. John and Lance talked in the den, their voices low and serious, like thunder rumbling. Kaylee made herself scarce, which was probably a good idea. She hadn't intentionally done anything wrong, but her snooping had opened a can of worms, and Zell didn't really know how to talk to her about it yet. Lance and Jency took the shoebox and left. Zell went into the den and sat down. Feeling chilled, she wrapped her arms around herself. She wondered idly where Kaylee was, reasoning that the girl was probably fine. Her own child was her concern now. John came into the room after seeing Jency and Lance out. He had his keys in his hand. "I'm going over to Ty's now," he said. "Gonna have a talk with him. Let him know how this is going to play out." She nodded miserably. "Want me to come with you?" "No," John said, jingling the keys in his hand. "I think we need to talk, man to man." He looked down at the floor, and she refrained from mentioning that she'd once begged him to do exactly that. "I'm going to stay with him until the police get there," he added, his gaze still on the floor. They picked out the wood together years ago when they'd replaced the carpet with hardwoods, visiting showrooms, browsing the samples, debating the different choices, colors, prices. It had seemed so important then. Now they hardly noticed the floor. They just walked across it. "So they're going to report him to the police?" John nodded. "Lance is concerned that he might have seen Jency at his house tonight and might resume his old behaviors. He feels it's best to get the authorities involved, just to ward off any possible issues. He's much less likely to try something if he knows people are watching out for him to do just that." Zell nodded. "I can see that. I just..." she found John's eyes with her own. I just hate it. He walked toward her, crossing the room with his wide stride and mere steps. He took her hand, pulling her up to him. She buried her face in his neck and let his arms make her feel safe. Jean would take care of her. He would take care of them all. She'd known that when she'd married him, and she knew it now.
He's going to be okay. We all are.
She nodded, knowing he could feel the movement of her head against his neck.
You take care of Kaylee, he said. I bet she's feeling kind of bad about what happened. She probably thinks it's her fault for finding the box.
Zell pulled back and looked at him.
Well, it kind of is, she replied, hearing her own cruel words as she said them.
She couldn't blame Kaylee for being a normal kid. Normal kids snooped around when they were bored. Even some adults snooped around when they didn't have anything better to do.
He put his finger against her lips. She doesn't need to hear that. She needs to hear she saved the day, that she found something very important that we all needed to see. He gave her a look. Because we did need to see.
She thought of all the things they'd been avoiding seeing, and for so long. He was right. There was much they needed to see. Lance held her until she fell asleep, this time not bothering to hide that they were in his bed together. They weren't fooling anyone, anyway. The children were playing somewhere in the house. He ignored their loudness, their hunger, their bedtimes. He let them feed themselves, fall asleep where they may. They would not die if they were unattended for one evening. They had food, shelter, TV, one another. Tonight his loyalty, his concern, his heart, was for Jency.
You're safe here, he assured her as she lay in bed and shivered, the shoebox sitting ominously on his dresser. He got up and threw a towel over it.
But what if he saw me? I was right outside, right there in full view. And you know how Zell runs her mouth. I bet you money she told him I was back, just making small talk. I can hear her now. Oh, Ty, didn't you know Jency Cabot? Well, she's in town for the summer with her two little girls.
Jency pulled him back into bed, her hands fisting his T-shirt as she looked at him with wide, terrified eyes.
My girls could be in danger.
He shushed her and pulled her closer, burying her head in his neck as hot, wet tears caught in the folds of his skin. I'm going to take care of you, he promised. He said it so naturally, as if it were nothing, but he heard the catch in her breathing as she reacted to his words. She was silent for a few minutes, and he feared he'd made a dreadful mistake.
I'm glad you're here, with me, she said. He kissed her.
Me too, he said. Me too.
Kaylee. I was sitting in the front yard when I heard Zell come up behind me. I had just seen Mr. John get in his car and drive away. I knew he was going to see Ty. I knew Lance and Jency were calling the police about that shoebox. And I knew she was coming outside to tell me she wasn't mad at me, that I'd done nothing wrong. I knew Zell would be concerned about my feelings and come try to make me feel better, because that was who she was. She was the kind of person who would take in a total stranger and make her feel like part of the family. She would love me, because she was a loving person, and what her son did didn't change that. But she wasn't going to get a chance to say anything to me, not this night. Zell started to speak, but I held up my finger, silencing her. I patted the ground where I was sitting, right by the pond in the front yard that she and I had made together. She tried to talk again, but I shook my head hard and pointed in the direction of Mr. Doyle's house. I put a finger up to my lips as she finally noticed what I'd been sitting there watching. I felt it was right to be silent as the funeral men in their black suits loaded Mrs. Doyle into the back of the hearse. Neither of us said a word as we watched Mr. Doyle wrestle Jessie back into the house
after the hearse drove away. We didn't say anything long after the neighborhood quieted down and the light faded. We just watched the night take over.
August 2014.
Wright.
Wright let Christopher go with the girls into the pool, then took her spot with the rest of the group, clustered in their usual area, a hodgepodge of lounge chairs, coolers, towels, and bags forming a base camp. Food and drinks covered the available surfaces, all in various stages of being consumed. Wright loved being part of the jumble of voices and activity. But today, Zell's chair remained empty. Kaylee had come with Jency and Lance for the last several days. Wright missed the older woman, always doling out advice and saying funny things. But she sensed something was going on and hoped that, whatever it was, it would blow over and Zell would return. Jency and Lance had been mute about it. But as of today, it was August, and time was running out. Their summer was dwindling. She remembered the early June afternoons, how summer had unspooled before them, a bright ribbon of days to come. They'd run out of days far too quickly.
Is Zell okay?
She broached the subject with Lance when Jency took the girls to get a soda from the machine. He blanched, nodded curtly, and looked away, pretending to be interested in the children going off the diving board.
Lance, she said. What?
Zell was, after all, his next-door neighbor. He was most likely to know if there was a reason she wasn't there. He glanced over at the clubhouse Jency had disappeared into with a panicked look.
I'm not sure she wants me talking about it, he said. She's still pretty upset.
Wright wrinkled her brow.
Jency is upset? With Zell?
He shook his head. No, not with Zell, but with her son. So it's complicated.
Wright was thoroughly confused. Jency'd had very little, if anything, to do with Zell's sons, either of them, then or now. What could she possibly be upset at one of them about? She pressed Lance for more information.
What happened? You have to tell me.
She had a deja vu feeling, hearkening back to the many afternoons with Everett and Jency spent at this same pool. Jency and Everett were the couple then, but she'd talked to Everett every chance she got. She could only dream back then that she'd be the one married to Everett. She thought of her looming meeting with Trent, of risking the very thing she treasured most if Everett ever found out. Jency, done buying the sodas, got stopped by a neighbor, buying them time because the woman was notoriously long-winded. Lance looked over and saw her stop as well. He took a deep breath.
I should let her tell you.
Wright shook her head, dislodging thoughts of Everett.
She won't tell me. She's pretty guarded with me.
Jency kept their conversations at surface level. Kids, weather, the latest headlines and celebrity gossip. Wright liked to believe they would move past it someday.
She's guarded with everyone, Lance agreed.
Wright kept her mouth shut, waiting for Lance to go on.
I'm sure you knew the circumstances that surrounded her leaving here back when you guys were kids.
Wright nodded, thinking of going to visit Everett as he recuperated. He'd had a broken rib, a black eye, stitches in his lip. And Jency had left him like that. Wright had sat with him instead, slipped her hand into his as he slept, trying to make sense of her best friend's departure. He and Wright had grown closer as he recovered. She'd felt those first glimmers of hope that something might happen between them, eventually. She just had to be patient, give him time to forget Jency. The ugly truth was, despite her fondness for her friend, Wright was glad to have Jency out of the way.
The stalker, she said now, to Lance, who she could see clearly loved Jency.
Wright recognized the look he wore, the way he watched her. She looked down at his hand and noticed he was still wearing his wedding ring, too. She'd talked with his wife some in the past, made idle conversation when monitoring children in the pool
or passing each other on the street while walking. His wife had gotten into running, lost a lot of weight, and looked terrific when she left him.